morning, everybody.
Yeah. It is. It's awesome to be here at Crazy Lake, but I want to say good morning to everybody online across all of our other campuses in Illinois and Wisconsin. It's great to be with you all on this beautiful St. Patrick's Day. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I see some green out there. I know that St. Patrick's Day has just become a glorified excuse for most Americans to pretend they're Irish and for some of them to drink copious amounts of green beer. But I will say this, I am legit Irish. Or at least legit part Irish. I'm a healthy ethnic mix, but I got a good amount of Irish in me. And I will say this, St. Patrick is honestly, genuinely one of my real life heroes. In fact, my youngest son, Charlie, was born the day before St. Patrick's Day. He celebrated his 11th birthday yesterday on March 16th. And Charlie is named after Patrick, obviously, right? You may not know this, but Patrick's real name was Maywin Sukat. I think we have a graphic here, Maywin Sukat. And I wasn't much for the name Maywin, but I did kind of like Wynn. And so Tracy and I named Charlie Charles Wynn Walmsley after Maywin. And so am legit a huge fan of St. Patrick. If you actually don't know his story, let me give you the two-minute version because it's a great story. Patrick actually wasn't born in Ireland. I don't know if you knew that. He was born in England, born to a really, really wealthy family. But when he was a young boy, teenager, some people say, he was kidnapped by Irish pirates and enslaved in Ireland, actually, which is where he came to faith because he prayed daily for his escape. And 6 years later, he was able to escape, made his way back to England, and honestly was probably content to live out the rest of his days in relative comfort and ease there, but one day had a vision. And the vision is actually pretty cool. He was out and about, and he saw a man approaching him from the direction of Ireland. And as the man got closer, I don't know how he knew this, but he sensed that the man's name was Victory. And as the man got closer, he had a bunch of letters with him, and he handed Patrick one of the letters, and it crossed the top of the letter, it said, "The voice of the Irish." And as he started to read this letter, he actually heard the voices of the Irish people calling out to him, asking him to come back and to walk among them. And so he took that, he received that as a call from God to go and evangelize the whole of Ireland. And I love this about Patrick. It's probably my favorite fact about Patrick. He actually, when he responded to that call, he actually thought he was fulfilling the Great Commission in his lifetime. To Patrick, in Patrick's world, Ireland was the last frontier. It was the edge of the world. And that was the last unreached people group. And so he went there with the mission of reaching the entire island. And it was incredibly, incredibly hard for him. When you read the stories of what he had to deal with, he faced constant opposition his entire life. He was mocked and ridiculed for a number of reasons I won't go into, but criticized for almost everything that he did, lived his life routinely threatened with violence and kidnapping and all kinds of other stuff. And this is the best part, particularly somebody in ministry. Towards the end of his life, his ministry was sabotaged by the own priests and pastors that he had led to faith and put into ministry because they were jealous of his fame. But in the midst of all that, you can read about him. Patrick was far from a perfect man. He had a ton of weaknesses and sins and some other stuff. But in the midst of all of that, he never shrunk back from his calling, from that original calling. He never cowered or stepped back in the face of any opposition. He persevered through all kinds of stuff, battled for the poor and the oppressed like nobody ever had before him. And I love this. I read this phrase about him. I thought it was so good. This one thing I read said, he also never failed to forgive those who brought nothing but pain into his life. He was a stud. I'm part Irish, I'm part Jewish, about half Jewish, and can't get this Yiddish phrase that I heard a ton from my great aunt Millie. She would have said, that St. Patrick, man, he was a real mensch, right? He was a stud. He was a good dude. He got it done. But what I think is so compelling about Patrick is that one moment, that one moment with God, that vision of that man named Victory. And I just think it's so powerful that one moment with God like that not only changed Patrick's life, but changed the course of history, changed the course of a nation. Because by the time Patrick was done, man, he had personally baptized thousands of people. He'd started churches and ordained and trained pastors all over the place. And he took what was almost entirely a pagan nation and started a movement that would see that nation almost entirely come to faith in Jesus. And so just powerful what one moment with God can do, isn't it? And that's what we're going to kind of explore today, is the power of one moment with God, what that can do in our lives. And to do that, we're gonna look at the Roman centurion that was at the cross, that oversaw Jesus' execution, and look at the cross through his eyes. But to do that, or at least to begin with, I want to give you a sense of who that Roman centurion was. We don't have a ton of information about him, but there's some things that we can pick up. And one thing that we know for certain was that this was a very, very hard man. That this was a brutal man. And here's how we know that. Roman soldiers in general, okay, they were some of the hardest and cruelest and most terrifying people that you were ever gonna come across, right? Those that were there in Jerusalem, they were there for one reason, and that was to keep the peace. And the way they kept the peace was with a crushing iron fist. Okay, that's what Roman soldiers did. Roman centurions, though, were literally 1 in 100. They were commanders of 100 Roman soldiers. And the way they got that role, the way you were selected to be a centurion, was to be the hardest, cruelest, and most terrifying member of that group. Okay, if you were the worst of the worst, you graduated and became a centurion, right? And what's more than that is that there were probably, if you look at the size of the Roman garrison that was in Judea at that time, there were probably 20 or 30, probably about 30 centurions that were there. And of those 30, this guy was one of the most terrifying and hardest of that bunch. And here's how we know that. Because he and his men had earned the privilege as a privileged place as part of Pontius Pilate, who was the governor at that time in Judea, as part of his personal protective service. And so if you got to that place, if you were part of his private guard, you were the toughest of the tough. You were a mean group of people. And if you were a leader of that group, you were not a nice guy. Let's just leave it at that. But in that role, that centurion would have been present for everything that unfolded that day, right? He would have been there at Pilate's residence very early that morning when this Jewish mob showed up out of nowhere, shoving a guy that had his hands bound in front of him, right? A man that the religious leaders said had been claiming to be king of the Jews. Which is certainly nothing new. They'd heard that before, right? And when the governor ordered this insurrectionist to be publicly flogged and then crucified, it would have been this centurion that was given responsibility for carrying it out. And he would have been really good at his job because he'd done it hundreds of times, right? This was nothing new for him. And he knew what the job was. Make the guy's death long and miserable. Make sure everybody saw it. And maintain the peace one more day. That was his job. And so it was that centurion who probably oversaw the march of the criminal from Pontius's palace back to the soldiers' headquarters. And it was that centurion who probably just sat casually eating his breakfast while his soldiers harassed the prisoners, they so often did, because they had this board game of sorts that they liked to play with all of the would-be Jewish messiahs. And the board actually was etched into the stone in the courtyard at the Roman soldiers' headquarters. And those condemned actually served as kind of human game pieces. And so the prisoners were dressed in a mock royal cape, and they were kind of given a stick as a pretend scepter. But the soldiers would steal the stick and whip them with it and then hand it back, right? But on this particular day, the soldiers even went a step further and they pressed a thorny crown into this guy's head just to torture him a little bit more. But as it always did, eventually, the game would get tired. And when the game got tired, well, that's when the real work would begin. And so it would have been that centurion who superintended Jesus's flogging. Scott went into that great detail last week. I don't need to redo that for you. But he'd carefully observe as the prisoner was beat within an inch of his life, and he would only intervene just to make sure that the governor's orders were obeyed and that they actually didn't kill the guy before they got him up on the cross, right? And it would have been this centurion who organized the procession up the hill, the process assembling the wood frame, the securing of the prisoners to the boards, the nailing of the hands and feet, and finally the lifting of the cross up into the sky. And it would have been this guy who nodded approval for the final insult, a sign hastily made and placed above Jesus's head that read in a dry Roman sarcasm, "This is Jesus, King of the Jews," right? And then the hard work would have been done. And all that would have remained was the waiting, right? Just make sure no one was stupid enough to attempt a rescue and wait for the end to come. All in the day's work wasn't even lunchtime. But that's when this guy's pretty average day started to turn in a different direction. And at first, it was just some weird inclement weather, right? The wind picked up, a cold front swept in from the hills, and then the sun just disappeared behind some ominous-looking clouds, and the sky turned black at noon, right? Strange, but the weather was always unpredictable in this part of the world, and so whatever. But it was also more than the weather, right? As he was maintaining guard, the conversation between the criminals up on the cross was just odd. It wasn't typical for dying men that he'd heard so many times before. And the way the one in the middle kept calling out to God, it felt personal, for lack of a better word. The whole thing just felt strange. But then it was over, right? As he's watching, the criminal in the middle screamed one last time, and the centurion watched as his chest collapsed, his final breath escaping from his lungs, his body sagged, leaving behind a lifeless corpse. And so the soldier, the centurion, steps toward him just to make sure that he's dead. But as he takes a step, feels his right leg buckle, and he almost falls, but he catches himself. But as he catches himself, he realizes that the ground is moving beneath his feet, and slowly, softly at first, but then all of a sudden, a lot more violently, it begins to shake. And it wasn't his first earthquake, but this one felt different. And as he looked up and he scans the faces of the other soldiers around him, he sees it in their eyes too. They're spooked. They're scared, right? And then their fear turns to terror because the shaking has become so violent, so severe, that all the rock formations around them are splitting before their very eyes. And they'd never seen that before. And there's no way the centurion could have known this, right? But at that very moment, the temple veil, which is this huge, thick thing, splits all the way down from top to bottom, and in graves across the land where people have been dead a long time, dead and buried, they are starting to wake from an eternal slumber. They are physically resurrected. He couldn't have seen that. He couldn't have known that, but he felt it. He felt it. There was something in the air. That atmosphere was charged with an energy that he could sense, but he could not explain. And so in that moment, he looks up at the cross, right? And even though the body of Jesus has failed, and it's just a corpse, he somehow finds himself immersed in the presence of something that he's never experienced before, right? He'd done this so many times. He'd overseen so many crucifixions, but he'd never seen or felt anything like this. And in one single moment, overwhelmed by spiritual realities beyond his comprehension, these words pass through his lips. This guy really was the Son of God. This guy was the Son of God. This is an understatement. That's a startling confession. Unexpected to be sure, but way, way closer to inconceivable than unexpected. Because Roman centurions don't declare other people to be the Son of God. Roman centurions declare Caesar to be the Son of God. And if Roman centurions declare anybody else to be the Son of God, that's tantamount to treason. But you can hear it in those words, can't you? This man was the Son of God. And there's half sorrow and regret, and there's half wonder and maybe even hope, because there's something that is happening in this guy as he says those words. There's something that's coming alive in him. And you got to understand, this is a heart. This is a human heart that had been hardened by years, literally years, of daily brutality and of constant fighting and of an utterly cynical perspective that knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that the only thing that mattered was the strongest survive. And that's it. There is no other truth, right? In all of that, decades of ingraining of that was overcome by one single moment in the presence of God. Those words, that man was the Son of God. Okay? That wasn't a statement of fact, because he had no evidence for something like that. That was a statement of faith. And right there in that moment, that soldier, that cold and brutal Roman soldier, was coming alive to God because of one moment. One solitary moment in his presence. One moment in the presence of God began to transform a man like that. One moment in the presence of God released Patrick into his calling and impacted the whole of Ireland, right? One moment in the presence of God has more power and more value and more significance than anything we can possibly imagine. And honestly, that's a truth that we get not just from these stories, but that we get directly from the person of Jesus. There was this time several years before the cross, actually, even before Jesus started his public ministry. You're probably familiar with this, when he went into the desert for 40 days to be alone with God. Right? And he fasted as part of that time in order to draw close to God. And the Bible tells us that the devil appeared to him while he was out in the desert. And the devil knew that he was hungry. And so he tempted him and he said, if you truly are the Son of God, why don't you turn these stones into bread? And Jesus' response to the devil in that time has become, it's classic. It's become famous. But Jesus simply looked at him and he said these words. He said, people do not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. Let me say that one more time. He said people, meaning he himself, Jesus, but not just Jesus, you and I and everyone else, we all live not by bread alone, not by physical food, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And that word, that Greek word behind that word word is rhema. And in context, it simply means this, means the living voice of God. Jesus said, people do not live merely or even primarily by the physical food that they eat, but by hearing the living voice of God speak into their lives. People live, life comes from those moments when we encounter God. Think about that for a second. What does food give us, right? It gives us sustenance, gives us strength. It's the thing, if we eat right, that gives us health and vitality and all those things. And Jesus is saying, you want real health and vitality. You want real strength. You want real sustenance. You need to turn to something more than physical food. You need to hear my voice speak into your life. This is really profound. Jesus is saying that life itself emanates from these special moments with God, that life comes from those times when we encounter the reality of God in ways that we never have before. Life is found when God reveals himself to us and meets us not only in the midst of our everyday lives, but speaks to us about our everyday lives. And that the source of life, not just for Patrick, not just for the centurion, but for all of us, are those moments where God shows up, right, and leads us both closer to him and more deeply into the life he made us for. But unlike the story with Patrick and unlike the story with the centurion, it's not just one moment. It's not just one moment. God didn't design us for a single moment or a few moments, but for rather for a constant stream of moments, right? A rhythm of life where God would constantly be speaking to us and that we'd be hearing from him. It's a way that God wants to lead us. Right? These moments are how God says the things that he wants us to hear. It's how he shows us the things that he wants us to see. It's how he helps us feel the things that he wants us to sense. And ultimately, it's how he moves us to where he wants us to go. And when you stop and think about it, it's exactly what we should expect. Because the Bible talks about a God who is always speaking and whose expectation that his followers will continually be listening for his voice. This is the rhythm of life that God designed us for. And our greatest experience of life is found in those moments with God, moments where we hear his voice and sense his presence and see something he wants us to show us, because they move us into everything that he has for us. That's what Jesus was saying. I didn't have a great Tuesday this past week. Wasn't terrible. Wasn't the worst day ever. But wasn't great. At work, could not be productive, and I super needed to be productive. I had a ton to get done. Got sidetracked all day. Even the ridiculously easy things I couldn't get done. My son Charlie had given me his birthday wish list like a week beforehand, right? And I hadn't found 5 minutes to go onto Amazon and order the things that I need to order. And wasn't that worried because I have Prime, right? But then you get lazy because you have Prime and you still cut it close. And I hadn't even done anything with that, right? So just totally unproductive. And honestly, I got dragged into like 4 or 5 different kind of ministry challenges or issues that were just super emotionally draining. And so just was spent, exhausted and all that. And then towards the latter part of the afternoon, Scott came to me and he said, hey, Would you be willing to switch up with me? Would you be willing to take the message this weekend? He was originally scheduled to teach today, which is not totally unusual. That happens from time to time, that different teacher calendars get messed up and we've got to make adjustments. And so I agreed to help him out and take the message this weekend. But here's the thing you should know. I'm going to give you behind the scenes with message prep, okay? Like, there's a significant amount of time that goes into it, right? Like, you got to study the passage. You got to pray and do your best to try and hear from God. You got to organize and collect your thoughts, and you got to get filled up. And it's like, it's a pretty intensive exercise. And somebody like Scott, who's super experienced and done this a lot, like, that whole process, I'm guessing on average, that probably takes him like 6 to 12 hours, maybe on average, I'm guessing, right? You have super gifted teachers like Denville, who it takes about 6 to 12 minutes and he's good to go, right? Like, which, I mean that as a compliment. That guy's the most gifted teacher I've ever heard in my life. But then there's the plow horses like me, that it's at best a 6 to 12 day process, okay? And it's just brutal. And so immediately I'm like, oh my gosh, when am I gonna find time to do all this? And so I go home, and I had scheduled time in my day to work out before dinner, but I got home and I was so spent that I just said, I'm not gonna do it. And I collapsed on the couch, right? Just done. And we get to dinner, and Tracy made a really nice dinner for us all, and we all sit down to eat dinner. And there was a bunch of good, healthy options, but she had also made this loaf of bread. And she turned to me and she said, you have to try this bread. I can't believe how it turned out. It is so good, right? Which, if I'm honest, I was kind of annoyed by, because I'm trying super hard to watch what I eat, and I don't, specifically I'm trying to avoid a lot of carbs, and I didn't want to taste the bread, but I wanted to honor her. And so I took just a little, ripped off a tiny little piece of bread and ate it. It was delicious. And so I ate the rest of the piece of bread. And then before dinner was over, I ate three more. And so I'm four pieces in. And during dinner, our youngest son, he has this really bad habit of hiding all of his healthy food, shoving it to one corner of his plate, and then when nobody is looking, darting from the table and scraping it in the trash before anybody notices, right? And he tries this not once, but twice, okay? And the second time I lost it. I just barked at him. I looked at him and said, stop it! Sit down right now, and I don't ever want to see you do that again. Right? And 11-year-old Charlie, 10 at that point in time, sits in his seat and collapses into tears. Right? Tracy gives me that look like, really? That was necessary, right? You needed to do that. So dinner gets done. Everybody kind of disappears. I'm in the kitchen by myself, and there's a box of crumble cookies in there. You guys know crumble cookies? Yeah, you know crumble cookies, right? And it wasn't a full box. It was only like five left in there or something like that. But I look at the crumble cookies, and I know they're like 15,000 calories a cookie. And so I just sliced just a little piece off of one, right? And tasted it. It was delicious. And so I went back and I sliced just another little slice. And then the box was gone. All the cookies were gone. And I'm disgusted with myself, right? And so I do what any reasonable person would do, and I open the pantry door. And my kids have this super annoying habit, drives me crazy. We have like 19 boxes of cereal, all open, right? And all with just enough for like maybe a half bowl of cereal left in there. Just the fringe left in there, right? And so I pour the remaining Frosted Flakes into a bowl, and I added an entire pint of blueberries because I want to be healthy. And so polished that off, did the same to the Fruit Loops, right? And then I was almost done. I turned back to the counter, and there was the rest of Tracy's bread. And so finished off the entire loaf of bread, right? I wish I was exaggerating this, I really do, okay? I go upstairs, lay down on the bed, no workout, binge on bread and cereal and cookies, yell at my kid and make him cry. I'm just a pig. I feel so pathetic. Just like a complete loser. So I'm lying there. This thought comes into my head. Make one good choice. And wherever that thought came from, I shoot it a thought back. No. And I'm laying there. Jamie, just make one good choice. And I intuit in my mind that it's probably God. And so I get up off the bed. I go down. I find Tracy. She's out on the porch reading. And I just said, hey, I shouldn't have snapped like that at Charlie. I shouldn't have lost my temper. I'm really sorry. Kind of explained the day to her that I had. And I said, that's not an excuse. Just want you to know I'm sorry. Found Charlie. Hey, Charlie. Dad shouldn't have lost his temper like that. I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have done that. Charlie forgave me, which was great. I felt a little bit better. And I'm walking back upstairs and hear the voice in my head again. Good. Now make one more good choice. Fine. So I go put on my workout clothes. Gonna acknowledge after everything that I ate wasn't the most epic workout you've ever seen. But managed to work up a sweat and burn like, I don't know, 1/10 of one crumble cookie off in calories, maybe. But got done with my workout. Felt a little bit better. Showered, went downstairs. Sat in his chair and ordered Charlie his birthday gifts. Then was able to pound out like 10 emails that I hadn't gotten to earlier in the day. And then just as I'm sitting there, God begins to just flood my mind and pour thoughts into my mind about this weekend's message. And I don't want to exaggerate it, but honestly, probably somewhere between a third and half of the work that I need to get done came in 15, 20 minutes. Just populated my laptop. And what had been this incredibly pathetic, frankly, downward spiral got turned around and started moving in an incredibly positive direction because somehow in the midst of my own mess, I just sensed and intuited the voice of God speaking to me. And I managed to respond enough to what it was saying to me. And in a real, tangible way, I had altered the trajectory of my day. It led me more closely into the life God created me for and further away from the mess that I make on my own, right? You see, there's nothing magic about that. You just had a thought that you think was from God and you kind of acted on it. And I say, yeah, you're exactly right. That's all I did. That's all it was. It was just a very small moment with God. Right? The kind of small moment that God hopes will become a series of moments. And then maybe not just a series of moments, but an actual rhythm of life. One where he reveals himself to me in some way and I respond. Right? Leading me further and further away from the life that I'll create on my own. And closer into the life that he created for me to live. It's not that complicated, is it? But here's my concern. My concern is that many of us don't really expect to ever hear from God. That somehow we think that's for other people, but not for us, right? And because we don't really expect to hear from God, we don't prioritize it. Because we don't prioritize it, we don't ever really do anything to position ourselves to hear from God. And because we don't position ourselves to hear from God, we don't hear from God. And we miss out on so much of what he has for us. What's sad is the life that he has for us is just not that far from any one of us. It's so close. And it's not reserved for the super Christians or the spiritual all-stars among us. Like, it's for all of us. And it's not hard. It just requires a small degree of intentionality and a little consistency. So I was thinking about this because I know how easy it is to be skeptical and to think, yeah, I hear that stuff, but that's not for me. We've got 2 weeks till Easter. And I was just thinking about a simple 2-week challenge that absolutely everyone in here and everyone online and everyone across all of our campuses, that every single one of us could do. That's really not that hard. Just takes 5 minutes a day. And here's the challenge. Find 5 minutes, set 5 minutes in your schedule, 5 minutes away from people, 5 minutes away from your phone or any other kind of technology, 5 minutes away from as much noise as you can get away from, like a space where you can genuinely be alone with God and give some time and attention to him. And in that 5 minutes, I want you to pray a one-sentence prayer, just to kick it off. And that's the only thing you have to say. And that prayer is simply this: Jesus, teach me to hear your voice. Jesus, teach me to hear your voice. And then I just want you to sit and listen, right? And it'll be hard. You'll be distracted by a million different things. It'll be difficult to discern God's voice from your thoughts and all those kind of other things. But it's kind of like those old vintage radios, you know, the ones, I hate saying this now, the ones when I was a kid, you know, that you had to turn the dial until you could zero in on the right station, right? What you're doing is you're tuning your ear with greater and greater precision to the frequency of God's voice. And here's what I think you're gonna actually discover, is that you're gonna actually, in those 5 minutes, you're actually gonna become more sensitive to the Spirit of God. You're gonna more be able to quickly hear what God is saying and where God is leading. And I don't think it's what happens in those 5 minutes. I think it's what's gonna happen outside of those 5 minutes. That in all kinds of surprising ways, at unexpected times, and in unusual places, you're gonna have a thought. And something inside of you is gonna go, that thought's not from me. And you're gonna intuit that thought's from God. And here's what I believe. You're actually gonna respond to that thought. You're gonna do what that thought prompts you to do. And when you do, you're actually gonna experience God living in that moment. And you're gonna experience him in a way that you never have before. And you're gonna come alive to him in a way that you never have before. And that's gonna go increasingly from unusual to common to the natural rhythm of your life. And you're actually gonna begin to experience a lifestyle of revival. I know that's a big check, but I believe it. I can see it. And I believe it can happen for each and every person in here. And so here's what I'm gonna ask. If you have not had that kind of life or not had it to the degree that you've wanted to have it, I'm gonna ask that you would risk and that you would do that every day for the next 2 weeks. And right now, here's what I'm also gonna ask. I'm gonna just ask that you would, without much fanfare, without anybody else noticing, that you would just simply put your hands out in front of you as if somebody was gonna place a gift into it. Because I'm gonna pray what's called a prayer of impartation. And I'm gonna ask God to open your ears to greater measure than ever before, that you'd be able to hear his voice with more clarity than ever before. And that you would have the wisdom and the courage and the strength to respond to him like never before. And that you would begin to experience him like never before. And so God, I just ask those things right now. Holy Spirit, would you come, not just in this room, but over all our church, to all who are listening. God, like never before, would you open our ears? Would you open our eyes? Would you help us to sense you and see you, God, in ways that we never have before? And God, would you lead us into a stream of moments with you? God, a rhythm of life with you that helps us to experience life like never before. Jesus, we want you. Come, Holy Spirit. God, make us attentive to your voice. It's in your name we pray, Lord. Amen and amen.